This is Incomplete Design History, the Illustration Files, a podcast that explores overlooked and ignored topics in graphic design history. It is our goal to deepen and expand the knowledge, understanding, and interpretation of design history. Because history is messy, it's incomplete. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Renee Martin, and here's my co-host, Sam Washburn.
Hi, everyone.
Today we're going to be talking about prehistoric cave paintings and the tools and methods used to create them. Countless historians, archaeologists, and scientists study cave paintings. Some try to figure out the meaning of the ancient images, while others try to understand the purpose of the paintings, and still others study how those early artists did what they did, from figuring out the process of making paint to going and putting it on cavern wall. The methods, techniques, and tools used to make prehistoric cave paintings tell a lot about the beginnings of graphic design technology by answering how prehistoric people created them. Based on archaeological footprints, it is assumed that these prehistoric artists carry rudimentary lamps, paint minerals, food, and tools when they travel to find cave surfaces. Some of the cave paintings use illustration techniques we usually think of as more of a modern inventions. In the Chauvet Pont d'Arc cave in France, the paintings are clear examples of pointillism. The pointillism effect was achieved by the prehistoric artist painting a dot on their hand and transferring it to the chosen cave surface, White 2003. This technique was applied over and over again until it resulted in a multiple dots to form an image. These prehistoric cave paintings showed how the artist made choices about color, application techniques, tools, and even location. While it might feel odd to discuss ancient cave paintings in the context of graphic design and illustration, we must recognize that this is literally where both of them begin. What the historians and archaeologists and scientists have revealed is a set of creative choices illustrators and graphic designers still use today, thousands of years later.
This, to me, is such an interesting topic because of the fact that when you study art history like we have, I think it's part of our job, right? And all this design history and all this fundamental stuff, you have a giant mass of data from like the 20th century and the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And then the further you go back, the less data you have. So there's a lot of like connecting dots and trying to figure out what the heck is this.
Yeah.
When it comes to cave painting, it predates everything else by so many thousands of years that like I'm always sort of baffled when the researchers are even able to figure out how they did any of it, because they're basically producing all this stuff using material that we have no idea about. And well, they understand it, right? But culturally, it's like an alien planet.
Yeah.
Because it predates everything that we sort of have any sort of frame of reference for.
Yeah, it's insane. And I mean, there are theories, too, about how some of these cave paintings weren't even in caves, you know, and how they're on cliffsides. So and then just masses formed over them geologically. So,
yeah, then you have the craziness, which I'm sure we'll get into. But the fact that these things still even exist to this day. I mean, if you look at modern interpretations, you can't paint the side of a wall.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
expect it to be there 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Peeling.
It's just going to be the sun itself will just destroy it.
That's true. Bleach it out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So on the pigment and binders for paint, prehistoric art historian Robert Myron writes how the prehistoric designer was also a primitive scientist to create multiple colors from natural pigments. These colors in every hue except green and blue came from ochres, manganese ochre, charcoal, and blood, Myron 10, as well as hemonite, limonite, chalk, and charcoal. In the paintings at LaSalle, most of the iron oxides and pigments came from the surrounding areas in the cave along with ochres, Rospoli 170. 158 fragments and 20 tubes of powdered pigment have been excavated at various painting sites. Pigments found at LaSalle at the end of the Axial Gallery were produced in black, red, pink, brown, and yellow material. The chamber of the felines contained red, white, and pink pigments, and at a far end of the gallery, manganese in a powdered state, a nugget of mineralized manganese, and a piece of yellow ochre the size of an orange, by Rospoli 194.
So this left their crowns in the cave.
Yeah.
Basically.
Piles of it. It's insane that we're able to find it in the first place. Pigment source through the cave site suggests that the location was selected first and then the colors rather than the other way around. After selecting the site and sourcing the pigment, prehistoric artists needed a binder, something to hold the color and stick to the cavern wall, obviously. There were many of these natural binders, water, blood, honey, glue, fat, urine, saliva, and bone marrow all serve the purpose. Researchers and historians have concluded through experimentation that the best binder was made using cave water, which is rich in its salts of dissolved calcium that fix the pigments in the crystalline mass to form a very hard colored calcite, Respoli 194.
So you're basically using the cave water to apply pigment to the cave itself.
Yeah.
So you've got these natural materials that fit into the cave already, and it basically is like a nice little like souffle once the whole thing is cured together.
And it's like, how lucky were they that the cave water right there happened to be the best binder?
I mean, as far as we know.
That's true.
They could have been doing thousands of these every day.
That's true.
And then, like, it's like, oh, when some random guy goes into a cave and does it, no one sees it.
Yeah.
And yet we see it years later. All right.
Yeah, using cave water makes a lot of sense. Like the pigment, like we said, it's, you know, right there and readily available. Nothing had to be carried to the cave site. Iron oxide was also used for preparing pigment, along with a possible glue and resin, according to archaeologist Erwin Neumeier. This iron oxide material was called guru in India and was mixed with water to be activated. It was applied to the rock and chemically reacted with the mineral content of the cave surfaces, causing oxidation to allow the pigments to permanently stick to the surface. This lets the pigments of the painting show brightly even after the surface of the cave erodes. Neumeier, page 6. You know, speaking of surfaces, archaeologists have the reason to believe that prehistoric artists prepared the surfaces they painted by first scraping and washing the stone so that their strokes of paint would appear more realistic. Myron theorizes that prehistoric designers were inventive and skilled enough to create scaffolding out of vines and wood to reach higher cave surfaces. Once the paint was mixed and the surface was ready, cave painters then made their decisions about how to apply the paint. Based on other inventions like the scaffolding, it's reasonable to believe that prehistoric artists formed other tools to apply paint. However, this method, for which there's no doubt the use of their own hands. Existing cave paintings include literal handprints, which would have required the artist to dip his or her hand in the paint and press it up against the cave wall. It's also reasonable to believe that, at least in some cases, the pointillism effect was achieved with a simple fingertip. We can even say that prehistoric artists came up with the idea for spray paint and airbrushes. One design found in cave paintings is a negative handprint with color surrounding it like a stencil. There are many experiments done by historians and remains at cave sites to support the theory of spray painting. The two most commonly found possibilities for spray painting were spitting paint through a hollowed out bones or spitting them from the mouth directly. Author Mario Ruspoli theorizes that the spray gun method was seldom used, but it was achieved by being blown through the mouth or a hollow tube like a bone. French prehistorian Dr. Jean-Claude agrees, writing, hand stencils are made by blowing or spitting red or black paint onto a hand laid flat against the wall. For spitting or blowing, pigment was also placed in the mouth where it mixed with saliva, creating the paint before sprayed onto the cave surface.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen the handprint, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Because you were doing the research. Yeah. It's weird to me because it always looked to me like it was just a signature for like the larger mural that was going on there. But like, that's some dedication right there. I mean, obviously, like, they're working with material, like, they would work with. The idea of putting paint in my mouth and spraying it onto stuff just makes my stomach churn. So, like, knowing what we know now. But, you know, artists are pretty hardcore. So it's interesting to think about that done all these years ago.
I mean, you think about cadmium and lead used to be a regular paint. Ingredients, so
yeah, exactly.
Artists are hardcore.
I was gonna say, moving forward a few centuries, it's like some of the toxic material. Like, that's why I hate working with oil paint.
Oh, yeah,
to get way off topic, but like, you have to have a whole studio structure to do it safely,
yeah.
And then, of course, no one does it safely, so like the amateurs who work with it and stuff just have like these solvents and everything sitting out.
That's why we have water based, too. And that's also why, like, talking about this is important with prehistoric techniques and tools and paints and everything, because it's like nothing is new under the sun a little bit.
Yeah.
So with location, it's already obvious that prehistoric cave painters thought about their tools and methods. It only makes sense that they put as much thought into where they put their art. Long before we had the mantra, location, 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 prehistoric artists chose their painting sites intentionally. We may not fully understand what those places meant to them, but the work that went into painting where they did suggests these sites weren't just the nearest cave wall. Because of these discoveries, Historians have concluded that prehistoric cave painters traveled to find favorable cave sites and pack survival gear for the journey.
So it's like Burning Man in prehistory.
Yeah, I mean, no one ever thinks about that. Oh, yeah, I have to, like, you know, feed myself and mm-hmm. keep myself hydrated searching for a cave. I mean, it only makes sense, right?
Yeah, it's also kind of weird. I've always thought it's kind of strange because how many people can you pack into a cave?
Right.
And as we all know, artists love to show off.
Oh,
it's because we're antisocial. But we love to, like, show off for the stuff that we could do with our hands.
Yeah.
So.
Well, a lot of these caves, like, some of these people have never been in. Yep. You know, like, they don't know what's ahead of them. And they're just like, la, 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 heading into a cave. Like, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Myron mentions how some painting locations, like the ones in southeastern Spain, were not made in the darkness of caves, but on the sun-drenched surface of the cliff walls, overlooking the dwellings of Mesolithic man, where over time, rock deposits created a transparent film that preserved the images on the cliff, like we kind of mentioned before. However, there's sufficient evidence that suggests that these people traveled to the caves and surfaces they chose to paint on, and not just because their pigment was sourced near those locations. Archaeologists found numerous rudimentary lamps and lighting sources at cave painting sites. This discovery led them to believe that prehistoric painters invented ways to light their work for long periods. The lantern or torch would, in theory, have to burn long enough for the painter to find a surface in the cave, prep the surface, complete a design, and leave the cave. Processing the pigments took place outside the cave to preserve lamp fat or oil.
I find that really interesting that, like, they would leave their light source there to be found thousands of years later.
Yeah, they're just littering in the cave.
that's what always blows my mind is, like, we can only know so much, right? So
yeah.
I've always, like, thought, like, in the back of my head, how do you know someone just didn't go in later to look at it?
Yeah.
Got their looky-loo and then left and just, like, today. Like, if you go to any natural or, like, you know, man-made thing today, trash.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Like, I was thinking the same thing, like, plastic, candy wrappers. I mean, carbon dating is how we know anything, which is incredible that we have that. So Ruspoli goes into great detail about the variety of lamps found at La Salle and mentions that more than 130 lamps have been discovered throughout the cave.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. He goes on to split the lamps into two categories, natural and modified lamps. So natural lamps were more common as basic pieces of limestone or sandstone that ranged from 6 to 11 inches long and held a small well for fuel. Modified lamps were also made from limestone, but they were advanced with cups to hold the fuel of the lamp, usually sculpted. Ruspoli also mentions the remnants of possible torches, writing that, although in most instances the wood had disappeared, one still finds the charcoal fragments that were scattered on the ground as people came and went, as well as the smears and black marks on the wall where torches were scraped to revive them. There are theories about the possibility of survival packs used by traveling prehistoric designers. The prehistoric traveling artists carried a lamp along with fat for lamp fuel, strands of moss and wicks for the lamp, fat-soaked twigs, dry wood, crude harnesses, ropes, and sustenance such as smoked meat or fish. These travelers were prepared for danger and difficult obstacles, sometimes tackled alone. Contrary to the stereotypes of primitive humans, prehistoric cave painters were innovative and intentional about their designs, methods, and locations. Artists, illustrators, and designers still make the same kinds of creative decisions as the cave painters did thousands of years ago. In that respect, we owe a lot of debt of gratitude to those fine artists for heeding the urge to make the first marks on a wall and pass that knowledge on so that we could have the kind of art, illustration, and design we know today.
So that pretty much covers the whole topic.
Yeah.
But, like, again, really exciting stuff. Because just to go back to what I was saying earlier, like, this stuff is so stinking old that, like, when you sort of compare it to, like, the genesis of other art and design and things that we can call from, like, known human history and things like that, it just blows your mind that this stuff was available back then.
Yeah.
And it gives you that rare little glimpse into what the culture would have been like for the people who were doing this. And it's about the only thing we have besides, like, some pots and sharpened tools and stuff from burial mounds and things like that. But even that doesn't go back as far as these cave paintings.
Mm-hmm.
One neat little tidbit. I don't know if you found this in your research or not, but I'd always heard that, like, because of the fear of deterioration, the cave in La Salle, they actually built an entire replication of it and put it outside the cave because they don't want people going into the actual cave. Is that for real?
I don't know. I've missed that somehow.
Okay. Like, that was what I was always taught
really?
In school. Was, like, if you actually go to the site, what they've done is they've built out like an entire building where they recreated the cave. And the problem was when they opened up the cave to like tourism, all the people going through there and just breathing started eroding the cave, which is like...
And I can't imagine people touching it with their finger oils.
Right. And that's the thing is like... It, same thing when you look at like pieces of artwork like the Mona Lisa and stuff like that. Now it's all behind like high security and stuff like that. And they won't even let people clean them.
Yeah.
So you all you get is this idea of like looking at the thing through years and decades of soot and fingerprint.
Well, like that reminds me of, you know, in Branson with Silver Dollar City and the underground caves, they always say, hey, like, don't touch the stalagmites and stalactites because your finger oils will kill it. Like, it won't grow anymore.
Yep.
And that's just, we're all destructive by nature.
Meanwhile, I love whenever you do that, there's always some kids just like, poke.
Poke,
poke. Yeah. Just like touching the thing. Well, and it's just like, well, so much for that stalactite.
And speaking of poke, we're curious by nature, so that only explains how these prehistoric artists have discovered all these minerals and like colors and figuring out charcoal probably from their torches. And like, oh, I smeared this on the wall, it made a mark. Cool beans.
and like we forget that, like, because we're all plugged into screens and electronics and things like that, you forget
they were bored
how ingenious humans actually can be. Like, so we have to, like, we have to come up with these wild theories that, like, oh, aliens helped us build the pyramids. And it's like, no.
People did
like, people did it. Like, like, people have a lot of ingenuity and they're able to build these things.
Yeah, we're like the Romans and their insane road structures.
Oh, yeah, like aqueducts, things like that.
They had plumbing, too. Like, and then on the medieval era, they were like, what's plumbing? Anyway, I digress.
Anyway, fascinating stuff. All right, well, good job. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's always it's always nice to add in these extra things like prehistoric cave painting. It helps us. I think we got a pretty diverse selection going into this podcast season, but it's always nice to jump back and forth as much as we possibly can. Next week, artificial intelligence. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to research that until some more stuff happens.
Until like 50 years later.
All right, on to the credits.
This episode was produced from the aid of a grant from the University of Central Oklahoma. Research and writing credits for the episode are from Renee Martin. Story editing provided by Spencer Gee. Sound design engineering by the University of Central Oklahoma Center for e-learning and connected environments. Music by Christina Giacona and Patrick Connellan of Onyx Lane. If you would like to contact us about this episode or about the podcast, please email us at hello@idh.fm. That is hello@idh.fm. Our website can be found at idh.fm. You can also connect with us on Instagram at incompletedesignhistory.